Listen to the broadcast at www.enlightenradio.org. There's a player on the top of the page. And also, if you're on a smaller device, you should go to player.enlightenradio.org because it doesn't always show up on the small device. Supposed to. It's got all the, you know, the modern JavaScript things to make it work, but sometimes it doesn't show up on small screens unless you go to player. So, and our podcasts are always available at two places. One on podcasts.enlightenradio.org and also at democracyroad.podbean.com. I want to welcome my friend Harry Targ. And I know he, was reading one of his latest pieces on higher education. And at the bottom, a week or two ago, he had a reading list, you know, or a bibliography of some of the references and stuff that he had drawn from over many years. And I was reading the list, and I just got sucked into going down memory lane there, because it was like a memory list that I myself had about 40 or 50 years ago myself. And I said, wow, you know, I had all these great books. Well, a lot of them were very insightful and made good contributions to understanding U.S. foreign policy in particular, history of civil rights struggles as well. So it was a interesting moment when I was reading it, and I remember trying to write something like that because I had been an English major at one point, and I was into all these questions, and I was reading some of these books, but I don't know. I somehow had a skill at writing leaflets, but not long articles. So anyway, and the union, when the union hired me, that was probably the best thing they could give me to do. Anyway, so welcome this morning. This is my good friend Karen Valentine and I here. We've been doing a lot of local stuff, going to county commission meetings and interviewing local candidates, and it's quite a bizarre situation in West Virginia. So I think it would be great to have a little bit more higher level discussion today. It's a break from Karen told me a great one last night. She was at a gathering that was raising some money for her daughter's campaign, and someone was going to decide to run for our county commission, and I think you told me you asked her, have you actually been to the county commission meeting?
I highly suggest you attend.
You really want to go to that party. So anyway, welcome, Harry, and help us out here. Higher education has been in the headlines for the past months, looks like it's in crisis. What's your view?
Yes, thank you very much. First, I'll open with a commercial, but it feeds into what I'd like to start off with. A friend of mine and I, my friend is still teaching at Purdue University English Department, and we put together a collection of essays called From Upton Sinclair's Goose Step to the Neoliberal University, Essays in the Transformation of Higher Education. And that's a changemaker book. That's the end of the commercial. We used Upton Sinclair's title of a book he wrote in the 20s called Goose Step, which was a history of an analysis of higher education in the early 1920s. And in reading Upton Sinclair and his analysis of the connection between the economic ruling class and boards of trustees and the kind of curricula that were being encouraged or required in elite universities, it resonated a lot for us as to what was going on at not only Purdue University, but major universities around the country. So, that book was a kind of inspiration. And I later discovered, but have not read yet, that Sinclair wrote a book on the media concentration, and a book on religions and profit making. And if we want to talk, therefore, about using Sinclair as a parallel, I guess I would assume he was thinking, as was the then active Marxist theorist Antonio Gramsci about cultural hegemony, and was concerned about narrow capitalist control of higher education, the media, and religion. And from my point of view, that's still relevant today, and maybe even more so. So I've been experiencing and studying higher education using my former employer, Purdue University, as just one example. And I discovered that, of course, I'm not alone. There are lots of other people writing about higher education nowadays and having a similar perspective. And one California professor called this literature critical university studies. And I kind of like that label, and am comfortable seeing myself as part of that tradition. And critical university studies, I think, addresses at least three kind of questions. One, the connection between the university and the political economy and the military. And it's all clear. And in our book, we talk a lot about Purdue University's increasing connection with the Defense Department and the major contractors like Raytheon. A second dimension is the university as an employer. And so this addresses the questions of the relationship between the administration and professional and non-professional staff. And we are seeing a flowering and growth of movements of grad students, TAs, to organize faculty unions and associations like the American Association of University Professors are growing. And AUP has had traditionally the mantra of shared governance. That is to say, on educational matters, it's not the board of trustees or the administrators that should be making decisions, but the faculty. And increasingly, we see all around the country that administrations of higher education are shifting from people with an educational background to people who are, you know, political appointees or who are representatives of big corporations. And the third part of critical university studies has to do with curriculum. And, you know, I think this is what has motivated Upton Sinclair and Gramsci and Noam Chomsky and others. That is, what is the content of what's being taught in higher education? And maybe this is what concerns me the most. And I think that from Upton Sinclair's point of view and Gramsci and others, our experience of the world is very much shaped by major cultural institutions, critical superstructures. You know, when my dissertation was on childhood political socialization, and the project was to study how and what young people learn about the world and their connection in the world. And there were a lot of people doing research comparing the U.S. with Japanese kids and Scandinavian kids and African kids. And, you know, in general, I think we'd all agree that education is terribly important. And, you know, fast forwarding to today, I would argue that higher education is increasingly becoming contested terrain. And I like Naomi Klein's idea of the shock doctrine, that during certain periods, crises stimulate political opportunists to take advantage of these crises. And the crisis that I'm thinking of today is the attack on the university presidents at that congressional hearing in December. Former President Claudine Gay and the president of University of Pennsylvania and the president of MIT. And they were, as you know, excoriated for hedging their comments on university responses to anti-Semitism. And from my perspective, President Gay was really right to say that in response to anti-Semitism on her campus, that it depends on the context. And the context is the question of allowing students and others to say what they will. And if they're not agitating and causing danger to others, academic freedom and really the free speech obliges us to not try and constrain that speech. And but she was excoriated for using the word, it depends on the context, even excoriated by liberal corporate media like the New York Times. And it turns out, as I looked into this story, I realized that she was being excoriated for supporting diversity, equity and inclusion at her university. Of course, she's an African-American woman. And I began to dig into what's behind these attacks. And what's behind these attacks is a long-term strategy by Christopher Rufo, the Manhattan Institute, the Goldwater Institute. And if you go back 10, 15, 20 years, the Koch Foundation and ALEC, to transform higher education. And the more I read about this subject, and Ellen Schrecker does a wonderful job in describing the history of higher education, particularly her book on the 1950s and the impact of McCarthyism on higher education, I came to the view that higher education is under serious assault now. And the congressional testimony in December was just the shock, if you will, to increase the efforts to transform higher education and essentially to reverse the 60s is one way to put it. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll shut up, is that today the Chronicle of Higher Education posted a summary article on attacks on higher education, indicating there's legislation pending in 14 states to abolish programs of diversity education and diversity, equity, and inclusion in public universities. And of course, the assaults on higher ed in the Florida system are clear, bombastic. But I would argue the assaults are going on all around the country and oftentimes in more subtle ways. And I could talk a little bit about my experience at Purdue University. So that's the too long of the story. But I guess I would argue that the ideological contestation that undergirds the maintenance or challenges to cultural hegemony should include an analysis of what's going on, not only in higher education, but K through college.
Right, Harry, thank you. There's a lot to chew on. Karen, you have I got about five questions, but I was going to stop.
I know, it's stirring up a lot inside of me, to say the least. One thing I'd like to start with, I remember back in the 90s, early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when I was in college and having conversations about capitalism and where we were headed. And if we got too close to that imbalance between rich and poor, you know, the whole 90-10, you know, percentage thing, right. Was that 10% of wealth gonna change how people were educated? I remember having that conversation with some of my professors and you know, peers. And in my opinion, it's exactly what has happened. And, you know, I remember thinking, are we crazy? Is, you know, are we paranoid? Are we paranoid to think that, you know, this wealth gap, you know, that the 10% are going to want to like control everything. Well, we clearly were not paranoid. We weren't smoking too much weed and getting paranoid. We were spot on.
Just the right amount.
And yeah, just the right. And
You know.
it saddens me. I have three daughters who have made it through the university systems and did quite well and had great experiences, but I fear that it's so quickly changing, the type of educational experiences, humans in the in our system at least are gonna have.
Let me be part of my reading of the history of higher education is that in the main, higher education has been designed and supported to serve the interest of ruling classes. Whether you're talking about a church and education before the Industrial Revolution, or whether you're talking about higher education after the Industrial Revolution in the United States, or whether you're talking about Clark Kerr's vision of the multiversity that serves the interest of national security, as well as the growth of industrial and post-industrial capitalism. So from my point of view, the university as an institution and any society, and particularly in a capitalist society, is designed to serve the interests of the ruling class. Having said that, anomalies occur. And I think the 60s was an anomaly. And I guess at least John and I are old enough to remember the
Yeah,
60s.
that's the
There
truth.
was turmoil on campus. And I think we accepted the reigning ideology of John Stuart Mill. That we celebrate the university as a place of where the marketplace of ideas are afforded. So it was a place not necessarily to create one particular ideology, but to assume that the world is a world of contested terrain, and the university is one of the few places where you could have that debate. In the aftermath of the 60s, we see the emergence of programs in African American studies, women's studies, peace studies, interdisciplinary programs, and they were all institutionalized, even where I came from at Purdue University. In my judgment, if you look at Nancy MacLean's discussion of the Koch brothers and Alec and so on, and any number of other sources, one of the projects of these very powerful institutions is to reverse the 1960s. And one of Ellen Schrecker's recent books is called The Lost Promise. And the lost promise is we assume that once diversity, the university is a place where ideas are discussed and debated, were established and institutionalized, the problem was solved. And my argument is that we begin to see in the 80s and 90s, that David Horowitz, the Alexes, the Chris Rufos are engaged in the process essentially of reversing the 60s and recreating institutions that are primarily, if not solely, to serve the purpose of American corporations, military industrial complex, reinstituting an ideology that justifies
Racism.
Individualism and market-based celebration of the market, an institution that celebrates Americans' exceptionalism in the world, and so on. So, I think this is a critical point in time. And looked at historically, it's not unusual that universities serve those interests, but we in the 60s and 70s, expanded the role of the university into something else, something that we thought was more desirable.
Couple of questions. Well, first on just on the economic side of the matter, I think there's a distinction between private and versus land grant universities on this matter, even though there's some correlation as well. In a sense, it's to the in the sense that the corporate world or the private economy is driven by, well, one, the thirst for profits, but also by the change in technologies in the means of production and then and distribution of all goods and services. And there we all know that that the pace of those changes has increased, and the scale of their impact also has increased. So it's not surprising to me at all that where the occupations are going that have income, there go the universities who want to find jobs for their students. So there are economic forces of different kinds, including the biases of the major funders and donors, right, to the private universities, where the class interests of those folks are, yes, they're going to become dominant because wealth is more concentrated by several orders of magnitude than it was even in the 60s when Governor Rockefeller at the time said, expressed that the fact that the State University of New York at Buffalo was teaching socialism was an abomination that should be destroyed. And of course, he went set out indicting everybody involved, including me. Anyway, so that's not new, but the scale of it is new. And then I asked the question, are ideas ever, and institutions, ideological, are they ever completely disinterested? Can anything be completely disinterested? I don't think so. And that part, of course, I learned that from reading too much Marx, I suppose, but or I acquired it. So the question of free speech is never a settled one, in my opinion, ever. And because, the change is the dominant thing that's happening, okay? And ideas are our reflections of those changes. And there's nothing that's going to, every institution, including very liberal or socialist or communist ones or whatever, everything over time, organizations tend to atrophy, right? And institutions form patterns. I think that you could look at the State Department, which has been fighting socialism for 70, for 100 years now, okay? And it doesn't know how to do anything else. You have seven generations of workers in the State Department who have been doing this one thing all over the world, basically trying to clear the path and remove all obstacles for corporate marketing and selling our goods and services all over the world, and doing it under a theory of domination as the best way to have it keep it secure. How do you have security in all these places where we're having? How do you keep the governments from nationalizing or taxing somebody, United Fruits Company in Guatemala? How do you keep them doing it? Well, you make deals with all the militaries, and the diplom and all the the ruling class. You set it up, and that's security, and now you can do business. But if that's the only, the problem is, then you end up with two world wars and a never-ending set of conflicts, and now you have two war two th now you have the guy that's supposed to save us from Trump is a mass murderer. He didn't want to be. I don't think he doesn't want to be, but he got sucked into it, and he's doing it. Because the cement between Israel and the United States is a loaded with horseshit, okay, over 70 years of it. So it's and you get stuck in these situations, and it can't move. So it's not surprising that they're going to try to repress on major universities, demonstrations that are going to disrupt those institutions. I think you just have to, it's like one of my favorite quotes of all in all the movies was in the one about The Post, where Ben Bradley is challenged about publishing the Pentagon Papers, and he said, "How do you defend the right to publish? You go to court?" No, he says, "You defend the right to publish by publishing, period. And you defend your rights by asserting them. You defend free speech by speaking freely." I don't think there's any other remedy, to it. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, you've said a lot like
Yeah,
I did.
well, I don't know. I just got carried away. I
First,
apologize.
the minor 2 points, and the second one, I'd want to dwell on more. We had the former very successful in terms of popularity governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels, became the president of Purdue University. He appointed the board of trustees, and then they hired him to be president. And he initiated many things. First, it was embarrassing to him that someone disclosed an email that Daniel sent saying that he was glad that Howard Zinn had died. So that was an embarrassment. But he has promoted STEM, and there's been a significant shift in resources in education for science, technology, engineering, and math. And over the last 3 or 4 years, sustained efforts in liberal arts to essentially eliminate the Department of English. I had occasion a few years ago to look into the education and employment linkage. And there's some data to indicate that while graduates in STEM fields may have a short-term salary advantage, over 10, 15 years, the salaries of people with a degree in English versus engineering turns out to be the same. So we're essentially being sold a bill of goods about the link between education and job and income opportunities, let alone the kind of skills that a humanities education would bring. So that's part of the ideological rationale that administrators use to demean these programs that don't fit the STEM fields. And a lot of people in the STEM fields would be very sympathetic to the humanities as well. I used to teach a course on U.S. foreign policy, and the engineering students were great. And more than once, a student said to me, boy, I'm glad I had this elective so I could, you know, take something that is more meaningful, if you will. So that's part of the story. Secondly, I think I agree with you that any institution, any influential institution like education or the media or the church or popular culture institutions, Hollywood or television, are very much impacted by the interests of the ruling class. But what's unique about, I'll call it the ideology of higher education, is that it rationalizes itself as being a space that allows for discussion, debate, and intellectual confrontation. And I think that's what those of us in the 1960s were calling for on college campuses, and young professors who got jobs in the 1960s and 1970s. And that vision, I like the metaphor of the university as contested terrain, that vision of higher education is being seriously challenged. And being seriously challenged in very dangerous ways to outlaw student organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace or Students for Justice in Palestine, or establishing laws, there's legislation pending in the Indiana legislature to require boards of trustees to establish committees to oversee discussion and debate on individual college campuses, and to be concerned about the rise of anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism should be defined as including the popular one that any criticism of Israel, for example, is one measure of anti-Semitism on college campuses. So there's a sustained campaign going on now to eliminate those programs that have celebrated and encouraged diversity of thinking. And now you have a major presidential candidate declaring that the United States is not a racist country. And, oh, yeah, there was slavery, but that's really incidental to American history. And so what you see is this sustained campaign to abolish debate and intellectual contestation. And when I would teach, I tried my darndest not to punish any student who disagreed with me. I tried my darndest to create an environment where we could have serious debate with people of very different points of view. And that meant I felt obliged to express my point of view as well. But that's the image of the university as one of the few places in the country where young people can get together and talk about social and economic and political issues. Our knowledge of the history of the Middle East is really limited, right? The formation of the State of Israel, the wars in 56, 67, 73, and beyond. I've been reading Ilan Pappe, and I have Rashid Khalidi on my bookshelf to read. And that kind of information ought to be part of what's taught in the university as well. And it's not. And increasingly, people who assign Ilan Pappe or Rashidi's textbook for a course on, you know, international relations will be, their positions will be jeopardized. So I think that's what's going on now and why I think it's such a threat.
I think it piggybacks on what you were saying about reversing, you know, the 60s, because when I, you know, I often try to step back and look at things from the lens of the average American, like when we scratch our head and say, who can really believe the stuff coming out of Trump's mouth, you know? So you have to go where these people are and talk to them and see how they think. And when we talk about corporate dominance, think about what they're watching day in and day out. I mean, the media is absolutely controlled by, you know, the systems, you know, the that want us controlled, you know? And so when I think about the only way even I am aware of young people's, you know, discourse on the Palestine-Israel conflict is that I still see a little bit on television, on the PBS NewsHour, you know, about what's going on college campuses. You know, I still, you know, read excerpts, you know, from the paper online and stuff like that. But the average American isn't doing that. So the one last place that we're seeing a youth voice, because everything else is so corporatized, there's not a coffee house on every corner where they're hanging out talking. The mm-hmm. only place we see it is if one of the news organization picks it up and mm-hmm. actually does an honest reporting on it. So most people that don't want to see what's really happening and how, you know, people really think, don't even ever get to see that there is a whole movement on these college campuses about the Palestine-Israel conflict. So that's what is scary to me. Like, if we lost that one last space, that one last institution where there is discourse and dialogue among growing minds. You know, even in high school, we used to be able to have debates and, you know, just really good debates about politics and current issues. I don't see that happening now.
Mm-hmm.
And teachers would be fearful to have yeah. such debates.
Republican Party in West Virginia just proposed to make intelligent design you can't forbid the teaching of intelligent designs by any teacher. And of course, we have about 60% of our teachers are not actually teacher certified; they're substitutes in West Virginia. So, and you know, I mean, the argument was just complete. Two high school students appeared before the legislature and swore that it had nothing to do with religion. So this other one of the delegates asked him, well, then what other, you know, non-evolutionary intervention are you discussing? Are you, do you think we should teach about what's in Area 51? Anyway, and so it got ludicrous, but it passed.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican, so we'll see. I mean, it passed one house. We'll see whether it passes the other. But anyway, you're talking, you have this stuff in our legislature going through. I wanted to ask you a question. What about hate speech?
I've never been comfortable with that notion. I haven't thought about it a lot. I tend towards a First Amendment absolutist or a free speech absolutist. And when I began writing, I was reminded of the old Oliver Wendell Holmes decision in that 1917 case, where I think he used the metaphor of you can't cry fire in a crowded theater, so that maybe speech should not be absolute, but that metaphor maybe is the best that we could do if hate speech can demonstrably be shown as a stimulus for violence against people. I guess I would be sympathetic with restraints, but I'd be very careful about that. And I think probably someone who's a little different than me could make the case that the Fox News Trump narrative has encouraged violence against targeted populations. And so that's not a good answer. I don't know what you guys think, but I am troubled by restrictions on speech and advocacy.
The problem is who decides.
Yeah.
You're right.
Well, I guess where I'm coming from is I think the horse is out of the barn on this one, because I mean, true. Trump is hate speech. I mean, half of what comes out of his mouth.
Yes.
And what my fear is the desensitized we become to words and speech and dialogue and intellect. And it frightens me. You know, where there's no thought behind these words. There's no, what if I say this and, you know, this happens? The concern, the care, the true meaning is just lost out the window. And so, I used to be a little more conservative with the, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, but we're yelling fire in a crowded theater every other minute now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think the only way to counteract it is to kind of protect, like a purist ideology of free speech, and try to just continue to overcome that hate speech with the words that we all need to be saying, with the dialogue we all need to be having. I don't see any other way out of it.
I think promoting solidarity has the greatest possible impact. When people are united, okay, for example, in the situations in the labor movement where people get to the point where they realize that they have no other protection other than themselves. And at that point, I notice, I always many times observe that people began to, if they're going to form a collective effort, they will form their own code of conduct many times that they are comfortable with to make this commitment to each other. Okay, because solidarity requires making a commitment to each other. And it means not leaving anybody behind in that bond. So, for example, you know, shops where we were organizing and where we had a significant enough majority to, you know, and experience had taught these lessons to people, they treasured it. And if somebody started to wreck the thing, it wouldn't last very long. And just, you know, it became quiet. I think that's that there's something about community and cooperation principles that can make that not have to have people arrested to enforce or beaten up either. So that's my thought on that one. I don't know.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting standard. When I think about this, my reflections on higher education and the promotion of certain ideological predispositions, what is implicitly embedded in higher education now is the promotion of what one theorist called possessive individualism, a view of the world that we are each engaged in a struggle against everyone else, and that's interpersonal and international as well. And I think where one of our strengths on the left is a sort of solidaristic vision of human existence, and that ought to be celebrated and encouraged. And I think, you know, I don't know if that's exactly where you were going, John, but I think that's just terribly important. And that's what first turned me on years and years ago about the Port Huron Statement, is that I think it reflected solidaristic thinking. And we have to celebrate that and encourage it.
Well, I got to dance with Jane Fonda because of it.
Oh,
when she and Tom Hayden came to Buffalo and they got a big speech and we had a party for them, you know, and we had a little dance. I got to dance with Jane for about.
Oh, wow.
I used to on my VHS tapes when I was doing aerobics in my living room in the 80s.
Yeah. Right.
Anyway. The Jane Fonda workouts. That was I loved them.
That's right. Well, listen, Harry, we're at about our 40. We're over our 45 minutes. It's been wonderful talking to you. We could go on forever.
Agreed.
But I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. And
thanks for inviting me. And I too enjoy it.
Well, I'll get my podcast up this weekend, and so you can, you know, we can circulate it a little bit more. But thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Very good. Even though it was early in the morning.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been the Winners and Losers radio program.
Thanks, Karen and John.
We'll see you next week, Friday, 7:30. Take care. It's late, right. But everything comes next.